This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to another edition of the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. Information has such significant power that it can no longer be simply an enabler. The U.S. Navy is in the midst of evolving its information capabilities from 20th century supporting functions to core warfighting capability. It's about providing information to any device, anywhere, at any time, giving the U.S. Navy information dominance and the capability to quickly identify, counter, and defeat threats. With us today to discuss his efforts in this area is our very special guest, Vice Admiral Jack Dorsett, Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Information Dominance and Director of Naval Intelligence. Admiral, welcome to the show.
Michael, thanks for inviting me today.
Also joining us from IBM is Chris Lyons. Chris, welcome.
Thank you.
Admiral, I'd like to start off. Would you tell us more about the creation, mission, and focus of the recently established Directorate for Information Dominance? And what are the strategic objectives of your command?
Michael, the creation of N2N6, the DCNO, Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Information Dominance, was the brainchild of our Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Gary Ruffhead. He had several key initiatives dealing with information that he's implemented. The first one was to create a three-star Director of Naval Intelligence. Subsequently, he combined that Director of Naval Intelligence with all other information capabilities under one umbrella. So the N2N6 deals with all elements of information, resources, policy, requirements on the Navy staff. The third item that he did was created an Information Dominance Corps, which is about 45,000 people strong in the Navy. And that organization manages, operates, is the functioning arm of Navy's information capabilities. And then the final most significant element, I think, was he created the Fleet Cyber Command, or recommissioned the U.S. 10th Fleet, which has responsibility for cyber operations within the Navy. Within my organization, the N2N6 at Navy headquarters, the CNO gave me his intent, and from his intent, I basically translated that into my strategic objective, which is to pioneer, field, and employ game-changing information capabilities that give information dominance over potential adversaries and decision superiority for U.S. commanders and operating forces.
With such an important mission, would you give us a sense of the scale of your operations?
My organization is about 600 people strong. We have experts in requirements, resources, programming, in intelligence, in computers, command and control, networks, electronic warfare, cyber, a whole range of information-related capabilities. And it's pretty unique to the Navy. I think we've had similar type of structures within the Department of Defense in the past. But for the Navy, this is a fairly revolutionary step.
So I had a follow-up. How does it integrate with the Fleet Cyber Command or the 10th Fleet?
The pretty simple structure. As I'd mentioned, I'm responsible for requirements, resources, the funding, the banker, if you will. And then the 10th Fleet Commander is the operational commander for Navy's networks. He manages the networks. He defends the networks. He's responsible for our cyber operations, both defensive and offensive operations. He's got operational responsibility for electronic warfare. So a very unique and distinct definition of responsibilities. So I partner with Vice Admiral Barry McCullough, the 10th Fleet Commander, and I'm his banker, and he's the guy who's at the front end of the spear.
That's great. Thank you for that overview. Now that you've kind of provided us with a sense of this larger operation, organization and its operation, maybe you could tell us a little more about your specific responsibilities and your dual role as the Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Information Dominance and Director of Naval Intelligence. How do these roles complement each other?
Chris, a good question. In fact, when you have one a broad set of responsibilities and then also very unique responsibilities, that responsibility for Director of Naval Intelligence separate from the Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Information Capabilities, you need to make sure that there's a clarity and ensure that there's no ambiguity between those roles. For the information dominance responsibility, I am the CNO's principal advisor for all information capabilities. So what is the future of the Navy's networks? Where are we going in terms of command and control? What is our architecture for our networks? How are we going to bring ships and aircraft to communicate together? How is information going to flow? Those are all in my portfolio in that portion of the job. My day-to-day activities, in addition to being his advisor, are for programming and resourcing the future Navy capabilities. So for acquiring equipment, ensuring there's money for training, ensuring that we've got the right organizational constructs for the flow of information across the Navy in very simple terms. As the Director of Naval Intelligence, I am the senior official in the Navy for intelligence. When you hear talk about the Director of National Intelligence and the 16 organizations that make up the intelligence community, I'm one of those 16 organizations, or I lead one of those 16 organizations, Navy's intelligence structure. From my perspective, I think those divisions of responsibilities are clear, but also there's great compatibility across them.
Regarding your responsibilities and duties, what are the top three challenges that you face in your position, and how are you addressing these challenges?
Chris, the first challenge is actually a pleasure as well, as I've got a very demanding boss. That's the Chief of Naval Operations. What's challenging is trying to keep up with him. Because of his great vision, he has, when we finish one phase of the project, in other words, creating an organizational construct, he's immediately looking at progress in the various areas, warfare disciplines associated with information. And, you know, we'll make progress on fielding a specific piece of equipment to collect electronic signals, and you'll go in and explain that to him, and then immediately thereafter he'll give you another task on unmanned air vehicles and their integration across the Navy. So that's the first challenge, I'd say, and it's really pretty exciting. The second challenge is when we created the Information Dominance Corps, that 45,000 strong structure. We had different cultures, disparate organizations, definitely different mindsets, I think, and bringing them together, the individuals together. The CNO refers to various organizations within the Navy as tribes. So we basically had tribal councils early on, and then we had to find the commonality of purpose and our objectives. And that's taken us about the last 9 months. And I'll tell you, we've made tremendous progress. So there was, I won't say resistance, but in some case, reluctance or skepticism on whether that Information Dominance Corps should have been created. But when the CNO said execute, then all the members that were responsible for leading came together, and we're working for common purpose. My third challenge is, I'm thankful that you've given me this opportunity, Michael, to be here today, because the third challenge is communicating the vision and explaining to our various constituents, to include those within the Navy, what it is that we're actually doing in the Navy and how much I call it a revolutionary change that we're actually going through. So communicating the vision and explaining the changes is really paramount.
Admiral, I'd like to learn more about you. Could you give us an overview of your career path? How did you get to where you are now?
My career path initially was pretty traditional. I started out going to ROTC, Naval ROTC at Jacksonville University. When I was commissioned, as a surface warfare officer. Started out on two ships, USS Oldendorf, which was a destroyer, followed by USS Dominant, which was a minesweeper. With some guidance from seniors and also a recognition that the surface warfare community was a perfect fit for a lot of people, and I'm not sure it was quite a perfect fit for me. I really enjoyed it. but I was looking for an alternative. And I transitioned to intelligence. And after I transitioned, after about 4 years in the Navy, I've been in the Navy 32 years, 28 years as an intel professional has just been outstanding work and employment. And my affiliation clearly with the Navy has been really beneficial for myself and my family. I've served all over the world as an intel professional in London, in Italy, a couple tours in Hawaii, San Diego, Newport, Rhode Island, Bahrain, and in Washington, D.C. on several tours. And each job has been progressively more challenging, and it's dealt with intelligence from the tactical level through the strategic level. My most recent assignment prior to this duty was as the J2, the Director of Intelligence for the Joint Staff. So I've really been blessed with opportunities throughout my career.
Given your experience, Admiral, what are the characteristics of an effective leader in an increasingly interconnected and networked world?
Brings to mind a quote from, and I'll try to paraphrase this, from Dwight Eisenhower. He said once that the supreme quality for leadership is unquestionably integrity. Without it, no real success is possible, no matter whether it's on a section gang or on a football field, in the Army or in an office. I tend to agree with that. The most significant professional qualification or characteristic, I think, is integrity. That's got to be the foundation of the profession. A couple other characteristics that I think are really critical is, especially at the more senior officer level, is vision. And in this dynamic environment and age that we're in today, leading change. And frankly, that's true whether you're serving in the Navy or you're working out in industry or in a legal firm. The changes that are predominant in society today are so frequent and so dominant that you need to be agile, and senior leaders need to be able to have a component of that. And also, especially in the military, taking measured risks is an important characteristic because nothing is simple anymore, and you can't just rely on the status quo. So you have to reach out into the unknown, unexpected, and that requires you to take risks at time, but really in a measured approach.
Well, I was wondering if, because we are in this new cross-boundary networked environment, does it call for a fundamental change in how we lead in general?
I think it does, and if I could take your question and sort of translate it into something that's important for the Navy right now is, through most of my career, the Navy has been led by three primary organizational groups: surface warfare officers, aviators, and submarine communities. And they are the foundation of our Navy, there is no doubt. And organizations or communities like mine, Naval Intelligence, were considered supporting elements of that Navy. And my perspective is we are going through a transition period where those elements that have previously been considered supporting elements are now taking a more prominent role. It doesn't displace the other elements within the Navy, but it takes on a new and unique position, I think. So we're seeing changes in what is considered a leadership role within the Navy. We are seeing an increasingly diverse Navy, whether it's based on ethnic group or organizational affiliation or skill level. So what does it take to lead, I think, for our future? What is fundamental? I'd given you a couple characteristics, but I think one of the most important elements will be being able to lead increasingly diverse organizations within the Navy and groups of people.
What is information dominance? We will ask Vice Admiral Jack Dorsett, Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Information Dominance and Director of Naval Intelligence, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. From contaminated peanut butter to spinach, our food safety net has shown signs of fraying, with tainted products slipping through to retail shelves, causing human harm and economic ruin. Pick up the latest Center report on food safety and find out how critical private-public partnerships are enhancing the current food safety system in America. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our reports at businessofgovernment.org. What is risk management? How do you manage risk more effectively? How can risk management lead to better decision-making? And what about applying risk management in government? Pick up the Center's report, Managing Risk in Government, An Introduction to Enterprise Risk Management, and find out. This report is especially timely given the Obama administration's focus on accountability and transparency, which has prompted a renewed focus on proper risk management and controls. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and today's conversation is with Vice Admiral Jack Dorsett, Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Information Dominance and Director of Naval Intelligence. Also joining us from IBM is Chris Lyons. Admiral, the U.S. military depends on access to the global commons to project influence and power. To that end, would you explain the concept of information dominance? What are its key components, and how does it differ from information superiority in a naval context?
In our mind, information dominance is about using information to win on the battlefield, to enable our national decision makers, our operational commanders, and units who, and individuals who need information, enable them to take action to either prevent conflicts or to win in a crisis. In our thinking, information dominance is that you're taking information and the various disciplines associated with information, elevating them in importance, and thinking differently about how information elements are connected. So for an example, it's easy to stovepipe electronic warfare and treat that completely different from cyber warfare activity on networks. But in a future environment where the electromagnetic spectrum is a battle space in itself, you need to think across the entire range of information disciplines, because when you think only in a stovepipe fashion, you miss opportunities. It calls to mind the book The Medici Effect by Franz Johansson. He talks about when you bring different skills together, when you bring different expertise and functions together, like the Medici family did in 16th century Florence. They brought painters, artists, sculptors together, and they created new capability. That's what you're seeking, a flourishing of innovation within the Navy and specifically associated with information capabilities. And if I could give you an example, back in the Civil War, Stonewall Jackson in the Shenandoah Valley Campaign in 1862 did a fantastic job of knowing the territory. He knew the geography. He also had a series of spies that kept track of the Union forces. So he had, in essence, in 1862, information dominance or information superiority over the Union forces. Well, we're basically taking that very simple concept, and as you move into the information age, ensuring it's not just about geography, not just about oceanography for us, but all meteorological and oceanographic data and information, all information about the adversary, information about our own command and control capabilities and weapon systems, and bringing that together to have, we call it dominance over a potential adversary. And specifically, your question about information dominance or information superiority, you know, you can get into an academic discussion on definitions, but we use the term information dominance because that's what we think our nation expects us to have in a time of war, dominance over a potential adversary.
So would you outline the initial guiding principles that frame your strategic endeavor? And to what extent have those principles informed the development of the Navy strategic roadmap for information dominance?
Michael, one of the things I'm a big believer in is whenever you start any endeavor, you need to have a set of guiding principles. So we worked pretty hard when we stood up the organization and said, you know, what are those things that are going to guide us? They're going to be common and critical for our future. So we have a whole list. It's probably close to 15 or so, but I'll give you the top 7 or 8 or so. The first one is we believe that every platform must become a sensor. And by that, we mean if you've got a ship or an aircraft out there, if you don't put a sensor or a series of sensors on those platforms, then you've missed an opportunity to collect information to ensure that our commanders have better situational awareness. We think every sensor has to be networked. In pre-information age days, we've had platforms that were not networked, that only collected information for the sake of that particular individual platform. In this era, you can't afford to do it. Information that comes from one platform on one side of the globe may be critical to a national decision back in the Washington, D.C. area. We believe that every shooter or every weapon system that we have needs to be able to take targeting data from any other sensor. So that gets into the issue of interoperability of data flows. We believe that our aircraft and planes and submarines must have a plug-and-play sensor payload capability. What that means is we can't have proprietary information systems that various contractors have. We need to have a mechanism that permits complete interoperability. We also believe that we're going to, as a principle, transition from primarily manned to more unmanned and autonomous capabilities, not exclusively because we still have a role for individuals, for people in this, but more unmanned and autonomous capabilities. And I've already touched on this issue of commonality of interfaces, data links, and control stations. The CNO also has given us an additional principle recently, and he said, you know, we need to build a little and test a lot because our acquisition system is so cumbersome. If you wait to deliver something after a 7 or 8 year acquisition process and you don't experiment a little along the way, you might end up with something that shoots behind the target, that doesn't deliver what you're really expecting in the future. In terms of our principles, you've mentioned our strategic roadmaps that we're creating for information. The principles are the underlying foundation. Once you get the principles down, then it's easy to start building the architecture and then the roadmap and the vector that you want to send the Navy in. If you get the principles wrong, they'll tend to send you in a different direction. So we spent a fair amount of time in developing these principles.
Admiral, information technology is driving dramatic change and leading to an explosion in the volume of information, thereby creating both opportunities and challenges. In fact, the National Intelligence Council reported, "The growing importance of information technologies will make information itself a primary target in future conflicts." Would you outline some of the significant cyber and network threats and challenges facing the U.S.?
Chris, your question hits home to, I think, what is one of the most important questions of our day. And it's much more significant than just applicable to the U.S. Navy. It's applicable to the entire government. And that is, in an increasingly interconnected world, how do you increase access to vast volumes of information while protecting your own information, protecting your own networks and communications and command and control systems? So within the Navy, we see two current types of cyber threats. And to avoid going into great levels of classification, I'll just tell you that those are hackers, individuals who are trying to access computer systems for fun or for sport or to do some type of nuisance disruption, but individuals that are not affiliated with nation states or terrorist or extremist groups. And then you have adversaries that are true adversaries that are trying to disrupt, destroy, or steal your information. Those can be nation states. Those can be extremist groups. And we see both of those types of entities that are posing a clear threat to us today. This is something that's really critical, not just for the Navy, but for the entire U.S. government and even for our industry partners out there and other agencies. Because you look at this threat, the threat to the U.S. banking, financial institutions, to our transportation networks, to our food distribution networks, when you think of how automated it is to take food and distribute it from the heartland to coastal cities, it relies on communications and computer systems. So all nations face the potential that hackers and others can disrupt their command and control capabilities.
Thank you, Admiral. U.S. dominance in the information arena is clearly at risk. In what specific ways are current and potential adversaries applying information technologies and operations to counter U.S. military strengths and preferred mode of warfare?
Let me give you a couple specific examples. I think that's probably the best way to explain. In December 2006, a hacker, perhaps even a series of hackers, accessed unclassified computer systems at the U.S. Naval War College. That's up in Newport, Rhode Island. The hacking resulted in what we call a denial of service. You couldn't access your computer system at the War College. And that was a denial of service that lasted for about a week or so. That led to the system operators having to take the computer systems down completely, purge it of the bad virus that basically was applied to the computer, and then cleanse it and then bring it back online. So at the Naval War College, we didn't have access to computer systems for about a week. That's one example at a very low end of the scale of problems that can exist. Another example is in June of 2007, when Department of Defense computers in the Pentagon were inflicted with a computer virus. That also caused a denial of service. Over 1,500, as I understand it, 1,500 computers were shut down. Similarly, they were cleansed and then brought back online. And that attack also took over a week to correct. So various elements of the Department of Defense didn't have computers available for their daily use. Another example, a little bit more sophisticated, July 2009, in which a botnet, and a botnet is a large number of interconnected computers that are employing malicious software, that botnet was used to attack U.S. and South Korean government websites. The websites were overloaded, and that caused them to crash. The attack took place. It began on the 4th of July, 2009, and it not only affected Department of Defense, but Department of State, White House computers, as well as government computers in South Korea. So those were unclassified systems that were affected. I think the other important point that I can give you is that these types types of, you know, malicious activity is occurring on a daily basis. These three examples were had a more significant impact, but we're having to protect our computer systems on a daily basis.
Along with facilitating actionable intelligence, your larger mandate is to take a holistic approach to how the Navy manages and resources its information capabilities. What is specifically being done to transform the use of information from simply being an enabler to becoming a core warfighting capability? What are some of the institutional barriers in the success of this effort, and how are you working to break down these areas?
Well, I appreciate that question. It brings to mind a quote from Niccolo Machiavelli, who is a 16th century Italian philosopher and political scientist. Machiavelli said, "There's nothing more difficult to take in hand, more perilous to conduct, or more uncertain in its success than to take the lead in the introduction of a new order of things." And how true that is, because this creation of information dominance focus within the Navy is truly a revolutionary idea and concept, I think, for the Navy, something that we've been toying with along the ways, but it took Admiral Ruffhead and his leadership to bring it all to bear and move boldly in this arena. So we're taking an overarching look at information. I've mentioned it previously, breaking down the stovepipes and really trying to address information in its wholeness so that we deliver a unique and different capability more than the sum of its parts, I guess, is the way to describe it. We've achieved some significant successes over the last 9 months since we've been working on that. We've improved our electronic warfare capabilities, moved out rather smartly in unmanned systems, and have improved or at least stabilized some afloat communications problems, although we still have a long way to go there. The institutional barriers are nothing unique to the Navy. It's barriers that you'll see anywhere when you're trying to transform an institution. What we've seen initially, I think, were some individuals with rigid mindsets or individuals who were uncomfortable with changing from the status quo. Easy to overcome that. Takes some time, though, and easy to overcome because it takes dialogue, discussion, and as you start making achieving some successes, you'll see individuals with perhaps more rigid mindsets start coming out of their shell and moving forward. Doesn't mean you bring everybody on board, but you certainly get a momentum. The other thing is individuals who grew up in a single discipline, and you're now asking them to branch out and operate outside of their comfort zone. Maybe people that don't have rigid mindsets might have open mindsets, but if they're still used to their unique discipline, you're going to challenge them. That's, again, something that can be overcome with progress, with momentum, with success. I sort of see success builds on success in that arena. And then the final challenge that I've really seen is the individuals, because we did realign resources, individuals who lost resources were a bit uncomfortable early on and were threatened by that. My perspective is those people who lost things went through the five stages of loss. They denied it, they were angry, they bargained, they were depressed, and ultimately they're largely accepting. But that occurs in any organization where you shift resources from one place to the other.
Admiral, to deliver dominant information capabilities, the Navy requires a highly skilled information-centric workforce. You've mentioned the Information Dominance Corps. What are the core capabilities you are focusing in on for that cadre? And could you tell us a little bit more about the Corps?
The Corps, 45,000 people strong. It's made up of oceanographers, meteorologists, information professionals. Those are folks that work with communications, command and control, our network managers, information warfare professionals who are SIGINT professionals, signals intelligence, cryptologists. They deal with other elements of information operations, naval intelligence professionals. These are civilians, enlisted officers across the board in these various disciplines. One of the key components of the Corps in terms of what we expect is we expect each individual to deepen their professional skill. Then when individuals become more senior, especially at the officer level, we expect them to start broadening their skill sets and understanding information capabilities across more disciplines. So early on in a career, you're going to focus on electronic warfare, or you might focus on network operations or oceanography. By the time you become a captain, we expect those officers to then have understanding of cyber, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, to be able to lead a future Navy that requires all of these elements of information to be brought together.
As a follow-up, I'd like to know what your vision is for recruiting hiring or educating and then retaining such a world-class workforce in the information area. Does the Navy have to do anything to sort of change its personnel process in order to achieve success in this area?
We absolutely do. In the information arena, the true experts are really highly sought after. Clearly, industry, the civilian sector, go out and can pay a sizable amount of money for people who are really experts in the information arena. Within the Navy, we don't have the same luxury of resources to be able to pay people, but we do offer a dedicated service to the nation. We do offer opportunities to advance and progress as you move forward. So we've looked at our training, education, and recruiting mechanisms, and we realize that we need significant overhaul of them for these professionals of the future. Part of our current structure will still work for part of the workforce, but for a more specialized portion of the workforce, and let's just take cyber experts, for example, we are looking to create alternatives. We have created a new cadre of, we call them cyber engineers. We are going to hire 5 of them per year, just a very small group of people, and we expect them to be world-class in the cyber engineering arena. And we will incentivize them. We will take care and groom those individuals. And that is just one near-term example of what we're doing. We're also creating a cyber curriculum at the U.S. Naval Academy. They have a cyber center there. We've already done that at the Naval Postgraduate School. We are creating reserve centers with information dominance focus in some of the high-tech locations around the United States. And we're trying to figure out how do you bring a reservist, for example, someone who is really highly skilled, very professional, how do you bring them in to help us in the Navy? You can't bring them in a typical traditional reserve structure because they may have long hair and not want to get their hair cut and be in the Navy. But you know what they may want to do? They may want to serve the country, and some of them will. So we are looking at new and unique ways to deal with those experts. And we are just at the beginning stages of the discussion and dialogue. But I am convinced that not only the Navy, but the other services and other elements of the U.S. government are going to have to tackle this same issue. We're going to have to tackle it together because the workforce, the pool of bodies that are experts in these areas, is finite.
How is the Navy transforming the way it looks at information? We will ask Vice Admiral Jack Dorsett, Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Information Dominance and Director of Naval Intelligence, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. The term cloud computing is suddenly everywhere, with government leaders, industry executives, and the press all talking excitedly about this new concept. Moving to the Cloud, an Introduction to Cloud Computing in Government by David Wild, examines both the interest in and the technology surrounding cloud computing, and why it is receiving such increased attention. It tackles such questions as, what is cloud computing? What are some of the top challenges facing government leaders pursuing cloud computing strategies? You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. As society has become increasingly dependent on information technology in government, business, and in our personal lives, safeguarding private information created or shared on computers or the internet has taken on greater significance. How do you keep information secure in an increasingly interconnected and networked world? What is cybersecurity? Pick up the latest Center report, Cybersecurity Management in the States, and find out. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and today's conversation is with Vice Admiral Jack Dorsett, Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Information Dominance and Director of Naval Intelligence. Also joining us from IBM is Chris Lyons. Admiral, information dominance requires evolving technologies to accommodate better information flow, but it also changes the way we view information. To what extent does the U.S. military need to move from a mindset of need to know to need to share? And what are some of the ways this mindset can be transformed going forward?
The nation is going through a change in its mindset. Prior to 9/11, we adhered to a need to know process, and that was based on protecting information more than delivering information to small segments of the Department of Defense and throughout the intel community. Protecting classified sources and methods was the priority. Following 9/11, we shifted to a new culture at embrace sharing, and it was sort of a need-to-share mindset, if you will. But it hasn't been pervasive throughout the Department of Defense or the intel community. Some policies, some organizations wanting to have tighter control of information. So we've made good progress, but as you can see in some of the challenges in the national security arena, we haven't overcome all of those challenges. The new philosophy, in my mind, requires getting people, analysts, decision makers, facilitators of information to take that measured risk, where you branch out and you start trying to get information flowing to greater segments of the organizations that need that information. I think that you can transform the mindset primarily by having leaders, bold leaders, who embrace it, who demand that we shift from protection of information as the primary purpose to sharing it with everyone who needs to know. Clearly, the president has pushed that as a primary objective of his. And I see that in the Department of Defense. I certainly see that in the Department of the Navy, a requirement. But we have institutions that still embrace either the status quo or past patterns of dealing with information and who are still very protective. So it takes senior leaders and their demands to constantly put on pressure onto the organizations to get it to really shift. The greatest and most significant method to changing our culture, I think, is when you start having success. When you have success, you can't rest on your laurels. You need to take that, build on the success, have another success, and then create some momentum. And then ultimately, you will change a culture. But culture change is probably the most significant and the hardest thing to ultimately do in organizations.
You mentioned earlier part of your responsibility or charge, if you will, is to boldly introduce game-changing strategies and concepts. What does that mean in practice, and are there any historical examples that may inform your approach to breaking down those old paradigms and introducing new ways to perform?
The Navy is clearly not sitting idle, and hopefully you've got a sense of that in the discussions that we've had today. Recently, we've made some significant improvements in terms of delivering and focusing on the future delivery of unmanned air vehicles, Fire Scout, our STUAS, next generation of small air vehicles, electronic warfare improvements. We've recently agreed with the Air Force to partner between their Global Hawk unmanned air vehicle and our broad area maritime surveillance vehicle. These are high altitude, long endurance, 24 hours endurance air vehicles, and we are going to co-base and jointly man those squadrons. That's a fairly bold move, but they're basically the same platforms, so we're going to find efficiencies by bringing those organizations together. The maritime operations centers and making progress in those and linking those to the Air Operations Center, again, a partnership with the Air Force. For the long term, we're looking at new types of weapon systems and capabilities in the information arena. We call it a U-class, but it's an unmanned combat air vehicle that will be flying from our aircraft carriers in the future. We are marching out smartly in terms of investing in that. We are also looking to new mechanisms for fleet battle management. The Navy is not sitting idle. We want to be bold, look across a variety of different initiatives. In terms of historical examples, I can think of two individuals. One of them is a British admiral that was around at the turn of the century, Admiral Sir Jackie Fisher. He was first Sea Lord of the Royal Navy. He prepared the Royal Navy for the First World War. He witnessed the transition of their Navy from sail to steam. He introduced the battle cruiser. He introduced modern training techniques, and his legacy was one of innovation and excellence. The other example from our Navy is Admiral Hyman Rickover. When he introduced nuclear power into the U.S. Navy at the end of the 1940s, early 1950s, he revolutionized the U.S. Navy, not only in the type of propulsion system that we had, but how you recruited, trained, educated, and retained the officer and enlisted workforce that dealt with nuclear power. He had, we call it cradle-to-grave oversight of the nuclear power business. He broke down stovepipes to move the Navy forward. The examples that he's given us are perfect for the information age. It's not nuclear power that we're trying to deal with, it's information, and many of the lessons from Rickover are extremely valuable for us today.
Admiral, the Next Generation Enterprise Network, or NGEN, will replace the Navy's and Marine Corps' internet as the backbone for business and administrative needs. Could you tell us more about the plans for the Next Generation Enterprise Network? How do you see the capabilities of NGEN evolving?
Next Generation Network is basically a single, secure, and we think it's going to be a more cost-effective network. The Navy, the government, will own the network. Today, we've outsourced our primary network, NMCI, Navy Marine Corps Intranet. And the difference there is that we're going to treat our networks as a true command and control system. As we've talked about the information age, if your networks are not secure, if you don't have oversight and insight and ability to deal fiddle with your network, then you're at risk in the future. So we went down one path with NMCI. Our approach with NextGen is for us to own and operate and command and control that network. The most significant thing about NextGen is not just the approach we're taking with that network, but the fact that we have other networks. Next generation network is an ashore network. We have multiple afloat networks right now. We want to consolidate and converge into a single integrated, interoperable network that's ashore, afloat, and also connects our overseas bases. So it's going to cost us some money. It's going to take us some time to get there. But we have a vision, an architecture for migrating from the current civilian-owned, Navy-leased, if you will, network system to completely government-owned, integrated. We think that there will be great efficiencies, that in the end it will cost us less money. The hurdles, though, are going in transitioning from the current network architecture that we have to the future.
I'd like to ask you, in pursuing your mission, would you elaborate on your interactions with the Department of Navy's Chief Information Officer, who is actually on top of both the Marine Corps and the Navy?
While the CNO has given me and my staff responsibility for the requirements, the policy, the resources, I don't have responsibility for operations. In terms of CIO, Chief Information Officer responsibilities, I have some component of those, but there is a Department of the Navy CIO who has responsibilities for both the Navy and the Marine Corps. So I'm in a subordinate function there, and I take policy guidance from that Don CIO. Issues like compliance with congressional and service mandates, Clinger-Cohen Act, Federal Information Security Management Act, the Don CIO has that lead and responsibility, and our staff takes the lead from them and then follows and then executes that guidance. We and my staff have responsibility for the architectures, the capabilities, the portfolios and strategies, implementation, if you will. While the Don CIO sets up above us, working directly for the Secretary of the Navy, interfacing with the Department of Defense Chief Information Officer. So I think we've got a good mechanism. It'd be safe to say that neither the Marine Corps and their communications, Deputy Don CIO and myself and the Don CIO, we don't always see eye to eye on everything, but we sit down, we communicate, and ultimately we will solve our problems together as a cohesive group, just like the various services working with the Department of Defense CIO. Work together to solve issues.
So do you think that there's an effective structure within the Navy to improve IT Navy-wide? Is the fact that you are both the N2 and you have N6 responsibility, is that improving that governance within the Navy?
I think we have an effective structure, but I am also convinced that we need to make continued changes in our structure. I think we have still some holes in our governance. I think we have some ambiguity still in responsibilities. The creation of the N2N6 has helped part of that on the Navy staff. But if you look out across the Navy and you look at our Systems Command, SPAWAR, the Space and Warfare Systems Command, and you look at our program executive offices, we have and we communicate an awful lot, but I think we need to make some changes in processes. I don't know whether we need to make changes in organizational structure, but certainly our processes are not as refined as we need to. So we've had this N2N6 structure up and running for 9 months, and I basically deferred looking at overarching governance and looking between some of these other organizations and seams that I still see, deferred until about this time to start tackling them because I had other priorities. And now it's time to tackle that. So you're very perceptive because we don't have it completely right. We're heading in the right direction, but still progress needs to be made.
The Navy's multitude of appropriation funding streams and their sponsors make it difficult for an organization to invest and then be able to reinvest the savings. This has been an issue in the federal government, I think, for a long time. If a budget-run organization, if you don't spend it, you lose it. And if you save some money, how do you reap the benefits of that? Are there any investments that N2N6 is planning to make for cost reduction efforts that will be beneficial to the Navy as a whole?
There are. And let me answer that question after I go back and I'll touch on a DOD CIO issue. The Department of Defense CIO has recently held a meeting with all the service CIOs and the service leads for communications and information and has talked about changes to the acquisition system. And we all are in a complete agreement with the DOD CIO that we need to have a more streamlined, more agile acquisition system. And the current acting DOD CIO, Ms. Cheryl Roby, is contemplating some initiatives that will test new mechanisms for us to be a little bit more quicker and agile. And instead of procuring systems, IT systems that take multiple years, 4, 5, 6, 7 years to acquire, try to get things acquired in about an 18-month to 24-month time frame. So we're all very supportive of that. She's going to take a little bit of risk, managed risk, I think, as she moves forward. But I think that is great that we've got that leadership across DOD. In terms of your question, in the Department of the Navy, we're looking at consolidating our afloat networks. In fact, we have our system is called Consolidated Afloat Networks. We're looking at consolidating ashore data centers to try and achieve some efficiencies and reap some dollars. We're looking at moving towards more unmanned and unattended surveillance sensors and capabilities because manpower is really expensive. And if you can move to an unmanned capability where the support infrastructure is small, doesn't require lots of manpower, then you can reap benefits there. Same thing with our unmanned air systems, as we are going to move forward there because the costs associated with manning air systems are very large. An example would be our EP-3 specialized reconnaissance aircraft. Large number of people on the back end, they're doing special reconnaissance work. We need to remote the flows of information from unmanned sensors to ashore consolidated nodes where you can group people together and benefit from a reduced manpower pool, but one that is very, very specialized in skills. Right now, we put a lot of people up in the air, put a lot of people on ships, and it's not a very efficient or effective way to deal with intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance. And then finally, I mentioned the Air Force and the Navy looking to a new model for Global Hawk and our broad area maritime surveillance. Great potential for efficiencies there if we get that organizational alignment down properly.
What about the future of information dominance? We will ask Vice Admiral Jack Dorsett, Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Information Dominance and Director of Naval Intelligence, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Management of government projects, programs, and portfolios, and the related expenditures of public funds are major visible areas of interest and concern. Despite a growing stream of successful program and projects, failures continue at an alarming rate. Pick up the latest Center report, Project Management in Government, an Introduction to Earned Value Management, and find out how this powerful methodology can make your projects more successful. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our Center reports at businessofgovernment.org. Whether it's the federal government's role in emergency management, its efforts in making operations more sustainable, responsible, and efficient, or the challenges being faced and innovations being forged by local governments during difficult economic times, the Spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine offers timely, relevant, and thoughtful perspectives on all of these issues from leading practitioners and public managers. Hi, I'm Michael Keegan, Managing Editor of the Business of Government magazine. And we know it's all about making connections, introducing our readers and connecting them to the work of government executives who are leading agencies or initiatives that are focused on critical missions, missions important to them. In our latest edition of the Spring 2010 Business of Government magazine, we bring you conversations with FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate, who talks to us about the challenges facing his agency. Michelle Moore, Federal Environmental Executive, outlines sustainability efforts in greening federal operations. And Robert Doerr, Commissioner of the New York City Human Resources Administration, sheds light on how his agency is doing more with less. Our forum is dedicated to exploring ways government leaders and all leaders can make better decisions. All of this and so much more in the Spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and today's conversation is with Vice Admiral Jack Dorsett, Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Information Dominance and Director of Naval Intelligence. Also joining us from IBM is Chris Lyons. Admiral, I had an opportunity to read, and I really enjoyed The Art of Success in Naval Intelligence, your monograph. It provided valuable insights and principles for success that I believe are applicable to any profession. Would you outline for us the key characteristics of a successful naval intelligence officer? And what are some of the fundamental principles of success, and how do you actualize them?
Right. I don't know what the perfect example of a naval intelligence officer is, but I would say it's someone who's got you know, professional depth and specific intelligence skills, and that may be geographic area, Middle East expert, knowledge of a specific country in Asia. Might be someone who understands technical disciplines in terms of collection systems, whether it's space systems or reconnaissance aircraft. But one thing that's fundamental to all naval intelligence professionals is you need to be an analyst. Part of your job throughout your career is analyzing information, analyzing data, and then being able to convey that information in either written form or verbal form to decision makers. Intelligence is a profession that contributes to decision making. It is not the decision maker. So being a good analyst is really solid. In terms of success and what other attributes are critical for a successful career in naval intelligence, I've already mentioned integrity as the foundation. But professional competence, again, in one or multiple skill sets, leadership, vision, especially at the more senior levels, teamwork, really critical in this era more than any other time because of, the youngsters are constantly communicating in ways that I never even envisioned when I was younger. You can't work it alone. If you're an independent analyst, you can be the best independent analyst in the world, but you're going to miss opportunities and you're going to miss data and other ways to look at information if you're not teaming with other individuals. Clearly, taking care of your people and in this Navy today, taking care of our families is critical not only to naval intelligence professionals, but for anyone in the Navy. If we're not taking care of the families today, it doesn't matter how well we treat our people. The families are the ones that make the decisions on whether the sailors in the Navy stay in or not. And I think key for all professionals is setting clear standards and holding people accountable. Those are key attributes of the Navy in itself, but also the subset of intelligence professionals in the Navy.
You have firsthand experience regarding information sharing challenges faced in the wake of a disaster. Specifically, you were involved in Operation Unified Assistance in response to the 2004 tsunami. Would you tell us what you learned about information sharing in the wake of destruction, and to what extent did Operation Unified Assistance represent a successful model of transforming U.S. forces to become more agile, adaptable, and responsive to emerging crises?
That was a great experience for those of us in the Navy. And Admiral Tom Fargo was the commander of the Pacific Command at the time, and the current Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Gary Ruffhead, was his deputy commander. So I think we all learned together that when you're dealing in a humanitarian assistance or a disaster relief type of operation, the basic Navy command and control system, the basic Navy structure, were organized to succeed quite well in an organization or in a disaster like that. We have the agility, we have mobility, but in terms of information, we learned an awful lot in the tsunami relief operations because we had a government organization, we had intelligence structures that were designed to deal with classified information, to use national space systems, and it was more cumbersome. And what we found out in the tsunami disaster was you had to be more agile, you had to deal with non-government organizations, you had to deal with a host country, Indonesia, at which at the time the U.S. government had just a modest relationship with, and the military had very limited relationship with them. So we had to, on the spot, create mechanisms to pass information. We reached out to get unclassified sources of information, and quite specifically commercial space satellite to first identify the breadth of the disaster and then help the local agencies that were supporting local populations to try and feed them and house them. My view is that the Navy learned an awful lot. We applied those same lessons during the recent Haiti earthquake. We were agile. We partnered with the Marine Corps. We partnered with NGOs and other services, the Army on the ground. We came in there rather quickly. In fact, that's where the Navy and the Marine Corps' strength is we can get to places relatively soon. We can start the flow of both information and goods, and then we get out of the way where other experts, the non-government organizations, the Red Cross, the UN can come on in and jump in on top of us, but we established the basic foundation for success. So we not only learned from the tsunami disaster, but I saw those lessons built upon during the recent Haiti operation as well.
And are those lessons also amongst coalition partners? I mean, it's not just a U.S. effort.
No, absolutely. It really is. You're in my business area, you're talking about sharing information that's unclassified, going to unique and new sources, whether it's doing a Google search or going to a non-government organization that you know has had a long-standing relationship in the affected area, say Haiti in this example. You partner with them rather quickly. You exchange information, and my goodness, how much more effective can you be? And then when you throw on top of that social networking, the flow of information can be rather dynamic.
Thank you, Admiral. With the evolution of the global threat environment and many challenges associated with it, how do you envision your command and its efforts evolving in the next several years to meet these challenges? And what emerging technologies hold the most promise for enhancing your efforts going forward?
We're using, we call them roadmaps, but it's basically a guide for the various war fighting areas that we're looking at. We're going to create a roadmap for undersea. We're creating a roadmap for intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, for electronic warfare, for our networks. And there's a common theme throughout these various roadmaps. They are interconnected, but it's basically a game plan. You know, if you're a football player, it's a game plan for how are you going to operate over that that 60 minutes of football game time. Well, this is a game plan for the Navy for the next 5 years, these roadmaps. It's a foundation, and it's an attempt to bring everybody in the Navy and give them the same common understanding of where we're going to make progress in, let's say, electronic warfare. My view is the great thing about a true transformation is you can make pretty quick progress, but you need to understand what the objectives are, what the guidelines are. Otherwise, you're going to be inefficient. You're going to be all over the map. In terms of specific technologies, I wouldn't want to go into too great a detail, but it's safe to say that we're looking at the integration of systems, whether it's radar systems or communication systems. We're looking at unattended and autonomous sensors. We're looking and partnering with others on cyber tools, intelligence and information fusion capabilities. I'll tell you, I think the Navy's lagged in that area a little bit. Some of the other services and others within the intel community have done a better job. We need to make some significant progress in that. And then our advanced data links and combat engagement capabilities, I think, are truly world-class, but they're not where we want them to be. So those are the technologies, some of the technologies that we're looking at to try and make investments in and achieve some great progress in.
That's a wonderful perspective. Sir, you've had a very interesting and successful career serving our country. I'd be interested to get your advice that you would have for someone who's thinking about a career in public service or military service.
The simple piece of advice that I think I've tried to follow, at least the latter half of my career and probably most of my career, is seize every opportunity. I don't think I've ever, when someone's presented me an opportunity, whether it's a new assignment or a task, I never shied away from it. I always took it. Some of the career assignments, when you're in the Navy, you go where you're told to go. Those were not always the jobs I wanted, but as soon as I was given the assignment, I got enthusiastic and jumped forward in that. So if you're considering a career in the Navy, I tell you what, the adventures are true. They're out there. I've had a wonderful time. I'd say seize the opportunity. That's the advice I give to youngsters, to relatives that I have that are considering coming in either to the Navy or into government. Don't miss the opportunity. There's one quote that really comes to mind that is a motivator to me because it's characteristic, I think, of my career. I never expected to be an admiral in the Navy. I was hoping to make a career of it after I'd gotten in, but I didn't know where I was going to go. And a few years ago, I looked back and I saw a quote from Lady Margaret Thatcher. She was the former Prime Minister of the UK. She said, "One only gets to the top rung of the ladder by steadily climbing up one at a time. And suddenly, all sorts of powers, all sorts of abilities, which you never thought belonged to you, suddenly they become within your own possibility and you think, well, I'll have a go too." So I think I'd conclude by saying if you're interested in government service or interested in the Navy, have a go because it is a great opportunity.
Well, sir, I want to thank you for your time today, but I think more importantly, Chris and I would like to thank you for your dedicated service to the country.
Well, Michael, Chris, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. I've enjoyed the conversation and hopefully the listeners will as well. And thank you for providing this, I think, service to the public. It is an interesting program that you have, and I've listened previously previously, and I never expected to be here either. So thanks for the invite.
It was wonderful having you. This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with Vice Admiral Jack Dorsett, Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Information Dominance and Director of Naval Intelligence. My co-host from IBM has been Chris Lyons. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thank you for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to join us every Saturday at 9 a.m. and visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.
How is the New York City Department of Environmental Protection using innovation to protect, collect, and deliver water to over 8 million people? What about the city's efforts to be greener and make its operation more sustainable? And how is New York City ensuring its water system is viable for the next 100 years? Listen next week as these topics and more will be explored with Cass Holloway, Commissioner of the New York City Department of Environmental Protection. Join host Michael Keegan next week on the Business of Government Hour.